Good evening, and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism Teleseminar. I'm your moderator this evening, Chantal Cecile Kira. I'm the author of three books, the latest one being Autism Life Skills, From Communication and Safety to Self-Esteem and More, 10 Essential Abilities Every Child Needs and Deserves to Learn. And I'm also a parent of one neurotypical teenager and a 20-year-old guy impacted quite severely with autism. And I'm very happy to be here this evening to introduce our guest this evening, who is Michael John Carley. I've known Michael John Carley for a few years now. I've had the pleasure of knowing him. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about him before he gives you more information as well. So Michael John Carley is the Executive Director of GRASP, which is the largest organization comprised of adults on the spectrum. He is also an accomplished author and speaker. Michael received his BA from Hampshire College in 1986 and his MFA from Columbia University in 1989. As the executive director of GRASP, he has spoken at conferences, hospitals, universities, and healthcare organizations. He has appeared in the media widely, most notably in the New York Times, the Washington Post, New York Newsday, the London Times, the Chronicle of Philanthropy, the Chronicle of Higher Education, Newsweek on Air, ABC News, Psychology Today, and so on. He's also been on the radio, on NPR, on Terry Gross's Fresh Air, as well as on The Infinite Mind. Carley was featured in the documentary On the Spectrum and in the soon-to-be-released documentary Neurotypical, the Movie. His article, Grasp at 1 Year, A Personal and Very Unprofessional Look Back, was widely circulated, and his other articles have been published in magazines such as Autism Spectrum Quarterly, TAP, which is the Autism Perspective, Autism Asperger Digest, and in newsletters such as The Oracle. His first book, Asperger's from the Inside Out, A Supportive and Practical Guide for Anyone with Asperger Syndrome, was released in April 2008. Until 2001, Mr. Carley was the United Nations Representative of Veterans for Peace, Incorporated. In that time, he was known primarily for his work in Bosnia, and in Iraq as the project director of the internationally acclaimed Iraq Water Project. Prior to 2001, he was a playwright who enjoyed 15 productions and 10 readings of his plays in New York. Along with his then 4-year-old son, he was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome in November of 2000. He lives with his wife, Catherine Herzog, and her two sons in Brooklyn. Welcome, Marley. You're very welcome, Michael. You're a very accomplished person.
Chantal, you could say that, or you could say, hey, why didn't anything stick?
Well, you know what? I think of you really as a Renaissance man.
That's the good way of spinning it, and we always go with the good way of spinning it.
Well, tonight you're going to be speaking to us about a new look at the needs of adults and teens on the autism spectrum, obstacles faced, and the myths surrounding their capabilities, as well as answering questions that people have been emailing in. But first, would you like, in your own words, after I've given that description and managed to mispronounce some of the words that I spoke, would you like to speak a little bit about yourself and explain to people more about what I've just described you as?
Well, I'll just sort of add just a couple of things on each segment. The first having to do with GRASP, the organization that I get the great privilege to be able to run. GRASP does a lot of things, but really its bread and butter are its regional support groups that have to be run by someone on the spectrum. Now, obviously, that person has to be, you know, capable of certain things, has to be willing as well as able. We do a lot of other things, though, educational outreach. We, you know, we've had to drop off the advocacy work a little bit of late, but the real main thrust of our organization are indeed those regional support groups where folks on the spectrum at any level, you know, come into meetings, and instead of support group meetings that are run by doctors and clinicians like we're all kind of used to, they, you know, suddenly sometimes can feel a little bit more trust because the person up there, you know, has that same juice as them, even if it's to a very, very different degree. Most of the time, if you're an individual on the spectrum, you've grown up trying to explain who you are to the rest of the world, and, you know, a lot of times it doesn't work out. And just like any of us, you get to a point where you say, you know what, I quit, and you internalize more. And suddenly you have this opportunity now with somebody up there that might actually get you to a degree that, you know, you're thinking, maybe I can trust this person more and expose more of myself. And so now, that having been said, the whole peer-run support group model is not something that we've invented by any means. It's a concept that's worked for returning war veterans. It's a concept that's worked for breast cancer survivors. It was just probably not thought of as being something that you could apply to the autism spectrum because of the communication issues having to do with these particular diagnoses. But we've had a very, very good run of it, and we very quickly, we had originally planned on going national in our seventh year, and not because we were doing anything brilliant administratively. We went national in our second year, and it was because there was a great need, and people were really, really ready for something like this. I guess the only thing on a personal level that I would add is that when my then 2-year-old son was starting to get looked at for a lot of the things that I'm sure a lot of the people on the line are going to be very familiar with, speech delays, motor skills issues, and he was stacking the bulk dog food that we, you know, would buy into these unbelievable shapes and patterns. He also wouldn't really play with toys. He would separate them into piles determined by shape or by color. And, you know, you give him a toy truck and he spins the wheels to see how the wheels move as opposed to, you know, actually, quote unquote, playing with the truck. And I had never heard the word Asperger's syndrome before. And it came into our lives as a very, very possible solution for, at the time, our only son, whom we call CC for public reasons. And when clinicians are starting to key in on the kid, they're also, because of the genetic nature of all of this, they're starting to look at dear old daddy out of the corner of their eyes a lot of the time. And one thing led to another, and he and I were diagnosed exactly a week apart in November of 2000. And so that's kind of how I came to all of this.
Oh, very interesting. Now, I would like to have you talk a little bit about your book before I start asking you some questions that people emailed in, only because I find your Asperger's from the Inside Out to be a very interesting book. Can you explain why you decided to write that book?
Well, there really was no – there. Right now, you are experiencing across this entire country – adults that, because of the expanding diagnosis, because of all the new public information that's circulating, and because just that type of knowledge tends to spread, it doesn't really get dumped on a population all at once. You know, you start out at some epicenter. You know, we like to think here in New York City that we're the epicenter of everything, and it generally trickles down everywhere. And what's happening right now is that adults are being diagnosed in retrospect in absolute droves, such as myself. Although at the time, I of course thought that, you know, what I was going through was something that nobody on the planet could possibly also be going through. And, you know, I find out that there's truckloads of people going through that very process. And there really was no book for them. There was no book that charted chronologically what you go through on an internal level about things like, what does this mean to your identity? About, okay, now that we've actually figured out exactly what we've got, we can, A, stop pretending that the way that other people might fix their problems in life might not apply to us, actually, and that there are actually, now that we know this about ourselves, other ways that we can try that have been somewhat proven. So it's sort of like, you know, the figurative example is it's like you've had the wrong toolbox to change the things in your life that you wanted to change, and now you finally have the right toolbox because you finally have the right information. And there's also a lot internally, you know, as to what goes on. You know, maybe, you know, you're somebody that grew up with ideas about anybody with a quote-unquote disability that, you know, left you thinking that people like that were just broken and that there was nothing you could do about it. That's going to make things harder if you had an upbringing like that. But for the most part, there really just was nothing out there that said, here's what's going to happen to you now that you've found this out. Here's what you're going to go through. And this is no small task, because an adult going through this diagnosis, you know, it's near biblical how almost every event that possibly happened in your life prior suddenly gets reexamined in this new light, and you come up with very, very different assessments and different conclusions. You come up with, you know, people that you thought were really awful to you, and then you find out, well, maybe they were actually just trying to challenge me. And maybe there are people that you thought were heroes in your life, and you look back and you go, that they weren't being very heroic at all, now that I think about this twice. You know, the point being that everything changes with this, and that that's a good thing, not a bad thing. And so to have some sort of a roadmap for people to at least get some idea of what they were facing with this late diagnosis was something that just was not out there. And I, you know, Tony Atwood has diagnosed more adults than anyone, but I've probably seen more adults after the diagnosis than anybody on the planet. So, you know, it was a book that I certainly had in me, and it was proven in the writing process. It really wasn't a struggle. It just kind of spewed out. And, you know, it was just one born from professional experience as well as personal.
Now, when I've heard you speak before, interviewed you in other situations, such as on my radio show, you've always spoken about the moment when you received your diagnosis as providing you with relief, or a sense of relief with the emotion that you felt. Did you want to speak a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, it was... There were two, I would say that there were two overwhelming positives, and that there were two very small negatives to receiving the diagnosis. And the two small negatives, one was that I had had a sense somewhere inside me all my life, and I was 36 when I was diagnosed, just to give people a frame of reference, I had had this sense that I was not connecting at all on an intrinsic or karmic or whatever level you want to call it, with the people in my life that I loved very dearly and that loved me very dearly. But you brush feelings like that aside. You go, no way can that be true. We love each other, so we must be connecting, right? And you just kind of sweep it under a rug for all those years. And I think one of the negatives was that this proved that, no, I really wasn't connecting with them. And that was a little hard to take. What you have to realize is that it doesn't really interrupt the love that's going on necessarily whatsoever. But in terms of what we think of as that, you know, really big sense of shared experience, no, that wasn't happening. I was processing thought. I was processing emotions. I was processing experiences much differently than the people that I loved. And I think the other small negative was just that we do have real stigmas attached to these words, like autism and Asperger syndrome. And I'm somebody that had had somewhat of a life. You know, my resume had some accomplishments on it. And now, you know, I was even, most of my behavioral differences, and this is where I was very, very lucky, is that most of my behavioral differences were lumped into the category of artistic eccentricity based on the professions that I found myself in. And so I got a free pass, where a lot of the other adults that I see certainly did not get a free pass and went through miserable, miserable experiences. So all these eccentricities are suddenly not a part of this really unique artistic, you know, personality of Michael John Carley. Now suddenly they're just lumped into the cold, stigmatizing mark of a diagnosis. And that's a little hard.
Right.
But the overwhelming positives blew all those negatives right out of the water very, very easily. The weight that was lifted off my shoulders was something that I'll probably never be able to describe. Every banana peel on my resume where I maybe hurt somebody's feelings, suddenly I realized I had not meant to hurt their feelings. I truly had not. And that when people made the mistake by thinking that I had intended to hurt their feelings, and I had thought to myself, but I really didn't, you still tend to go with the majority. If everybody around you is telling you you had intended to hurt their feelings, then you start to believe it yourself. And this freed me to tell me that I was a much better person than maybe at times I had led even myself to believe. I had supporters. You know, I was a rude so-and-so and a this and a that to my detractors. And to my supporters, I was a quote-unquote tell-it-like-it-is guy. Everything makes sense. All those experiences in life when you walked away scratching your head going, what the heck was all that about? And now you know. And beautiful to be conveyed over a phone interview.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing that with us.
My pleasure.
I'm starting with some questions now.
Sure.
Okay, so here's one. The first one I'm going to ask you is from Lisa Kirk in, from Caseyville. My 3-year-old son has, it's my 13-year-old son has great difficulty with social cues. I worry because he misinterprets them quite often. Any suggestions for therapy for him and where to go? He is currently seeing a psychologist. I've been unsuccessful in finding a social group. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
There's one particular form of therapy which we like very much, and that's what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, also known as CBT. And the difference with cognitive behavioral therapy is that it really takes the patient into the process of becoming their own doctor. It really doesn't have as much of a you lie on the couch and do what I tell you versus, you know, I sit in this chair and scribble notes and hold all the keys but don't share them with you, which can be a wonderful relationship. It worked for me for a couple of years at one point. But cognitive behavioral therapy really shares with the individual a lot about their own diagnosis. And the more that kids can start to understand about what they've got is only going to help immeasurably because, again, on their own, what they might be thinking is that, you know, I can take care of this like other people take care of this. And that's when a lot of mistakes start to happen. With cognitive behavioral therapy and with the whole notion of really learning about the diagnosis so that they also sometimes can start to alleviate the societal stigma that still accompanies these words, we just find that that's a wonderful, wonderful strategy in terms of, you know, psychiatric therapies. Now, that having been said, all these great ideas, whether they're therapies or, you know, anything having to do with policies or whatever, you know, this is all, you know, going to wind down to being about the singer and not the song, you know, and the wonderful practitioner that might be the better idea if they practice a less than ideal therapy versus the absolute jerk, you know, that practices your ideal therapy.
Right. Do you have any ideas for helping someone find a social group?
Really? With finding a social group, with finding a good school program, with finding a good therapist, it's really all about contacting whatever local autism societies or local GRASP chapters, if you have one, local agencies that really, or nonprofits, excuse me, that really deal specifically in the autism spectrum is always going to help more than cold calling through the white pages. You know, what you want is a reference. What you want to call people in the know. You want to get involved. You want to get on all the parent support groups, e-lists. You know, this is a situation where quantity is always better than quality if you're new to all this. So you really just want to absorb as much as you can because in a pinch, there's probably going to be somebody from your area that has been through this before and knows the field a little better.
That's really great advice because whatever autism support groups that are around, usually there's a parent there who's been through it all, and it's really good to find out what other professionals have been seen and what the opinion is, and also for what social groups are helpful for which type of child, you know, what
right.
kind of personality the child has as well. And I'm going to give you the website. I'm going to read the website right now for GRASP. It's www.grasp, that's GRASP.org.
What I would suggest to the people on the phone do, not your listeners, this isn't radio, do is to subscribe through the subscribe button there at the top. And when you subscribe or when you all subscribe, you're going to select the families and clinicians list from the drop-down menu. Don't, if you live in Philadelphia and you see that there's a Philadelphia group, don't hit Philadelphia because the regional groups are there for adults on the spectrum only. But what you want is the families and clinicians list. And that will get you also to an online Yahoo group where you can converse with people all across the country. And it's all free. So it's a no-brainer.
Okay, great. Okay, here's a question from an interested mom in Albany. Hi, Michael. I saw you speak in Albany, New York last year.
Oh, hi, interested mom. Nice to see you again.
You spoke of having a dog and how important that was to you as a child. I have an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old on the spectrum. I'm wondering if I should get a dog. I have mixed feelings about it. The extra responsibility I would take on to have a dog and care for it correctly is a big commitment. But at the same time, if you can tell me it helped you a great deal and it's what helped you get through the day, I'm all for it. Can you give me more details about your personal feelings on the subject?
Well, you're absolutely right, interested mom, that it is a big commitment. And overall, I think pets in general seem to have a really good proven track record amongst folks on the spectrum if they are indeed experiencing, you know, some sort of dislocation from their peers. The only thing I would, you know, before saying yes, by all means, go out and get a dog. Dogs are the best animals on the planet. Is that I was a dog person, and other people are cat people. You know, you have all these famous people on the spectrum that have these unnaturally large amounts of affection for certain types of animals. Author Jerry Newport has something like 30 birds in his house. Leanne Holiday Willey, who wrote Pretending to Be Normal, she's worked with horses all her life and now has a stable of her own, and that's her job now. Temple Grandin, probably the most famous one of all of us, has revolutionized the cattle industry because of her work with cows. And we certainly know lots of particularly women on the spectrum who love to have 50 cats in the house. And I was a dog person. So I guess it's really, you know, finding out which pet is one that your children are really, really drawn to. And if you find they're, you know, more akin to dogs, then by all means, go get a dog. It'd be great.
And if I may say, because my son has a dog, and he really wanted a dog, and so he does have an assistant dog who is very well trained. But it's true that when you have pets, it is added responsibility. So I think it's very good that the mom is thinking about that aspect. Because
absolutely.
That's not an added stress. What I would suggest, too, is to make sure that no matter what pet you have, that you start getting the children, or if it's just for one child, the one child involved in caring for the animal. Just starting in small ways, because that way it gives more of a connection between the animal and the child, and also, after a while, mother will feel less stressed, too, because the child will begin to take on a little more responsibility. But in saying that, my neurotypical 16-year-old has two cats, of which we end up feeding most of the time. We mean the adults.
Well, you know, I mean, they bring pets into rest homes now, you know, and it's because it's been clinically proven to reduce anxiety levels and reduce stress if you have a pet. I feel a little bit like a hypocrite in saying all this because as the last dog we had died in 2004 and with two boys and we live in a fourth floor walk-up, you know, this is the first time in my life in which I find myself actually petless. And I'm okay with that because two boys are enough responsibility. But I don't really know, you know, I think there's been some idea every once in a while that, you know, because of our diagnosis, we have some, you know, strange Star Trek-like kinetic relationship with animals where we can communicate with them on deeper levels. And I don't really buy into that. I think it's just that if we know somewhere inside us when we're young that it's not really working out with our peers as much as it would with as it is with other people, we're just going to put more of our energies into the animals.
Right. I see. Interesting. But it's true. Animals are great. It's, you know, they're great for everyone, I think.
They're great family members, not just pets.
Exactly. Exactly. Hey, here's a question from Deborah Presser from Fresno, California. What are your survival suggestions for parents with a teen and for the teen to get through that stage, I guess the teenage stage, relatively smoothly?
We're veering off the autism road here.
Well, I think it's with autism. I think both together can make a volatile mix.
No, I certainly understand that. I think that, you know, the joke aside, I mean, teens are really, if they're developmentally in line with their peers, what they're starting to do is really separate themselves and break away. They're starting the process of breaking away from mom and dad. And this is difficult for any family. And I'm sort of unqualified to speak of this as a dad, because the oldest is now 12, although he's really starting to give signals of, you know, that this particular part of separation. And, you know, I every once in a while catch myself just going, God, he's getting me to overreact, and he never did that before. You know, how is he doing this little magical trick? So I think that just not taking personally some of those, you know, separation gestures of his is probably going to help enormously. And for a teen on the spectrum, it really depends on the kid. I don't know where Deborah's, you know, child is developmentally or in terms of his executive functioning abilities. And without that, it's a little hard for me to sort of, you know, evaluate where he's at in line with other teens so that we can maybe start to, I mean, no matter what, his body, you know, is doing the same things as other teens. So, you know, hopefully some sort of a sexuality curriculum, no matter where he is on the spectrum, is out there for him. Both, you know, having to do with, you know, what's going on with his body as he goes through puberty and later, and also, you know, what's appropriate and what's not. I think that patience is probably just the best, and not taking things personally is really the best suggestion for any teen, whether it's on the spectrum or not.
And I think that a lot of times it's important to remember that even just neurotypicals, when they hit those teenage years,
Yeah. There's
so many things that go on that I think that when you have a child on the spectrum, it's kind of important to look at, okay, what is going to be happening because of puberty and the usual teenage stuff, and what is really due to the autism? And
right.
Teenagers in general have a lot of stuff going on.
Yep. I mean, one of the things, you know, that is probably, that I should probably state right now, that's probably going to affect a lot of these questions, is that a lot of times I get jealous of people that deal with kids, especially young kids, because kids have this very pure autism or Asperger syndrome where the symptoms are there, they match up with what's in the DSM, and you just work with that. But as anybody gets older, they start to have these things called life experiences. And it's those life experiences that sometimes, you know, well, hopefully some of them are positive, but the ones that are negative can produce things like anger and anxiety and depression, or non-chronic depression, because if it was chronic, you'd have been born with it. And it's very, very, very helpful, I find, for everyone to really separate, okay, what's the actual diagnosis at work here, and what's that anger, anxiety, and depression at work here? Because the diagnosis, obviously, you're not going to do anything about. You can improve on certain things on a cognitive level and, you know, various aspects of assimilation and getting by in the world. But the anger, anxiety, and depression, really at their root, are not a part of the diagnosis. They're just sometimes the inevitable byproducts of having lived life in the behavioral minority. And, you know, any marginalized population or other minority knows that it's a lot harder when you're in that position. So I think that, you know, if the anger and anxiety and depression are sort of really, you know, screaming out loud, I need a little bit of help here, then you treat that more, you know, you treat that with the knowledge of the autism spectrum disorder, but you're really after the anger, anxiety, and depression.
Good point. Here from Nancy Ricotta in Sterling Heights. Strategies for students in middle and high school to deal with bullying. Any advice?
Yeah, I guess lots. I mean, number one, if you're talking about just the student, which I don't think you should do, I think that, you know, ideas with bullying are a community-wide problem. I think that there are things to bolster in individuals. I think the walk away stuff doesn't work. I think that a lot of success can be had by giving them certain empowering trades, shall we say. And for some people, that might be yoga. And for other people, that might be boxing. And maybe trying to give somebody at least, you know, the mirage that they have it in them to defend themselves. And that also might be, you know, treating some of the anxiety that they might be experiencing because of these particular situations. But I really think that if there is a bullying situation, that the environment has to be addressed just as much as the child's needs. You know, we know so much more about bullying now than we did back when I was a kid. And not only are we starting to hold, you know, bystanders that do nothing much more accountable than we had in the past, but teachers, you know, we found out were a fairly, you know, culpable problem at times as well. You've got this kid in the class, you know, especially in mainstream schools, if you've got one kid on the spectrum, whether that kid knows it or not, and the kid is who he is and, you know, may inadvertently be indeed disrupting that teacher's class. Well, that teacher on a really subliminal level, if that kid becomes bullied outside of class, he's not exactly going to be feeling all that critical towards the kids that are doing the bullying. He's going to be even a little bit grateful, even if it's on the most surreptitious levels. You know, it's that whole thing of that kid had it coming to him that suddenly sort of springs out of nowhere. But no matter what, you've got to take the idea that this phrase, bullying is a part of life, is at the very least absolute garbage. It's a phrase that I find has been perpetrated mostly by people that in their youth were the bullies themselves. They seem to be the only ones who seem to throw that phrase around. And a lot of studies actually do show that those former bullies don't fall down in gutters after three marriages and a series of dead-end jobs and dead livers, and, you know, the last thought they have on this earth as they die of cirrhosis is, boy, I wish I hadn't bullied poor Johnny back then. You know, that was a great fantasy of everybody's. Turns out that the bullies now get really good jobs when they grow up. Turns out the bullies are actually thought of very highly in their communities. And the individual that does get bullied usually grows up with minor league versions of post-traumatic stress disorder and then feels doubly bad because he hears that garbage phrase, bullying is just a part of growing up, all the time. And so he feels doubly worse because all these years later, and he still hurts. And so that phrase makes him feel even worse, that he's a complete loser for still feeling hurt all these years later. So bullying is not a part of growing up. And unfortunately, it's an absolutely community-wide problem in terms if you're going to address it properly.
Do you recommend that book? I think the author's name is Nick Dubin.
Yes, Nick wrote a good book on bullying. And as a matter of fact, there's this guy named Michael John Carley who wrote the foreword for the book. So, yes.
Would you like to mention the name of the book?
You know, let me just check my library here. I'm at the office, so
right,
I can never remember the full titles. We in this industry don't write books with catchy titles, so they sometimes need to be.
It's Nick Dubin, D-U-B-I-N.
Yeah, D-U-B-I-N. It's Jessica Kingsley Publishers.
Okay. I'm going to continue here, Michael.
Go ahead.
And if we get it later on, we can mention it. But here's another question from Nancy. Ways to constructively combat school administrators' desire to reclass students from general ed supported to ASD when it's against the wishes of the parents and doctors.
Well, kids have this thing called the IEP. And if it can't be against the wishes of, if it's going against the IEP, then you can take them to court and sue them. So if this is on the IEP and the school administration is going against the IEP, you need to get a lawyer. Otherwise, that has to be a plan that you must have come up with yourself.
Okay. Cecily Murdoch from Hanscom has this question. Or maybe her name is Cecily Murdoch Hanscom. I'm really
No, it's Hanscom Air Force Base, I think.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry if I'm murdering people's names. I have a double barrel name, so I just assume everybody is. And the way these things are written on here, they have my double barrel name. Okay. Do you know of any resources that help military families in particular? Our kids deal with so much change, just moving as much as we do and starting all over again with everything each time. That must be quite difficult.
You know, it might actually, I mean, I'm not saying it isn't difficult, and I'm not saying that the kids don't rebel against it and are hurt by it, because we all know that, you know, transitioning from, you know, one thing to another is very often a challenge for folks on the spectrum, as is really any kind of change. You know, people on the spectrum like routine because it's sort of a safety valve in the midst of, you know, living in a universe that you don't really get some of the time. And routines are things that we can count on. There is, not to sound like the jerk football coach here for a second, but I mean, there is the possibility that experiencing change and getting used to change in this particular manner might actually help them long down the road, but you're not going to see that in the short term. So I understand the concern of Ms. Murdoch. There is nothing in particular for military families, and this is really just an absolute travesty, because usually in my experience, military bases where the families usually live are woefully underserved in terms of anything that has to come up, you know, anything that comes up that's out of the norm. You know, you're going to have your grocery store, you're going to have your pharmacy, all this sort of stuff, but anything specialized that needs, you know, kind of more outside-the-box attention is usually something that military bases, in my experience, really shortchange. There is no special legislation. Somebody had talked about something being proposed a while back, but I don't think anything happened to it, and it's really a shame. So, you know, all I can say is, Ms. Murdoch, it's not fair, and considering what you're going through and what you're sacrificing, it's really kind of a crime, and I apologize.
I may have a couple of suggestions, only because I live in the San Diego area, and we are very much a military town down
there. Yes, you are.
And so I can't off of the top of my head name any websites, but I do know that I see in the San Diego area where people have, on certain of the support groups here, mentioned resources for families in the military. And so I would say, if you want to contact me and email me separately, I will find those and email them along to you, because I don't know them off the top of my head. So that's the first thing. And if you Google my name, you'll get my website, and in there you can contact me by email. And the second thing that I want to say, something I agree with Michael in that over the long term it can help the child, but it is very hard moving every 3 years at the beginning. And what I would suggest is things that I have seen people do successfully just when they're going away on vacation or they're changing or moving in general is to have like a photo album where you're showing what it looks like to have a move, you know, when a truck's coming to the house, it's taking the things away, and that you end up somewhere else. So maybe the first couple times the child will not really understand or still going to have a hard time figuring out what's going to happen next, but after a while, when it comes to the next move, they're going to say, oh, okay, that's going to be happening again. And that eventually over time, anything new, you can be doing that, creating social stories, having stories about it. But pictures to begin with, if they seem to be in tune to, if their visual processing is working. But that's something that seems to have been working with many people that I've spoken to, you know, whether their child's on the more able end or on the less able end of the spectrum. So I would kind of suggest that kind of thing.
Chantal, that's a great suggestion. And I have one more, which is just that, and this is only if, you know, the child in question or the children in question can process such an idea, you know, not knowing where they fall on the spectrum necessarily. But if it can be communicated that because of the lives that that family has or the life that that family has as a collective, because of being in the military, if it can be communicated that that's really what is expected. It's not expected that we're going to stay in one hometown until you graduate from high school. You know, if you change the expectation of what is the norm, it might kind of bring things back around. And if there can be this idea that, you know, every couple or few years we move, and that if we don't move, then something really freaky has happened, and then you can freak out because then something will have happened with our life, you know. Just getting the child or the children to sort of understand the break in routine as being routine based on who they are and what their lives are all about.
Very good. Okay, here's another question from Erica Kirkland from Birmingham. My son is 15 and has Asperger's. He is high functioning. What can I do to help him make better peer choices? He is so easily influenced and tends to only get accepted by the non-desirable peer group.
Well, kids can be kind of cruel. And it may actually be the less desirable peer groups might actually be his best chance for learning social skills, if that's the group that has accepted him. Because you certainly don't want your child in a peer environment where he's disrespected or being made fun of all the time. I'll share a little tidbit from my past, is that, you know, you can talk about all my degrees and semi-lofty accomplishments, but that wasn't really what was expected of me based on people that saw me when I was 14 or 13 years old. And the straight-laced kids wouldn't have anything to do with me. Too weird, too this, too that. And I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, back at the time when Providence, Rhode Island was really just a mob-run, economically devastated dump. And some of the most notorious juvenile delinquents running the streets in that city took me under their wing. Now, it was a situation where I never, you know, did any crimes with them. As a matter of fact, they would every once in a while make fun of me for that fact. But it was still a situation where they came to pick me up and go, you know, have fun with them at night. And there was a lot of risk to this. You know, there was it was an atmosphere where there were some drugs, but I never did those. I drank with them, though. And that was still going to be not just the best chance at peer relations, but one that I really, really look back on and am eternally grateful for. Because I did at least have this sense in my mind, and I'm not saying that, you know, your child has this sense in her mind, but I knew that this was going to end sometime. I knew that things were going to probably improve and that I would be leaving these people in a figurative and literal way. And that thought running through it was just something I felt a little guilty about, because I did care about these people, even if, you know, I kind of knew a lot of them had really bad endings to their life stories probably at some point. But they taught me compassion. And they taught me that there are really a lot of great secret inner beauties in lives that are looked down upon by the rest of society. And I could never deny that those years, which I'm glad I got out of, don't get me wrong, but those years, you know, have made me infinitely a better person. And that's affected my work at every job that I've ever had.
Interesting. Here's a question from Lori in Ohio. I find one of the hardest things for my son is to talk to peers, both male and female, and I'm not sure how to help. I've worked with his school, but they don't seem to do anything to help. Any ideas?
Well, it really depends. I mean, the child might be having difficulty with small talk. There might be a lack of maturity, and so the child doesn't really know how to fit in and gets nervous and starts talking about something that might be inappropriate at the time. there's also maybe the capacity whether or not this child actually wants to fit in. I'm going to assume that, you know, he or she does, but there are plenty of children out there that just really don't want to socially interact because they're just not really that happy with their peers at that particular, you know, juncture in time. I would say that there's got to be some sort of a social skills class or group, again, if, you know, contacting your local autism societies or local grass groups or what have you, and to try and find something that, you know, will possibly help with this. But if it's something as small as, you know, pragmatically understanding what small talk is all about, I think that this is a child especially that needs to know about their own diagnosis and that needs to really start, you know, begin to read books, you know, like Freaks, Geeks, and Asperger's Syndrome, which was written by a 13-year-old kid with Asperger's named Luke Jackson, to start to realize where these mishaps are happening in conversation with their peers. It's kind of like, you know, if kids on the spectrum walk a little funny, you know, and they know about their diagnosis and they're not ashamed of it, then I just say, well, have somebody videotape how you look when you walk, you know, and compare it to the videotape of other people walking and then make the changes.
Good. Here's a great question. This is from Terry Woolridge from Baton Rouge.
Baton. Baton, you French person, you.
Baton Rouge.
If we decide to bastardize your language, yours is supposed to take it and lump it. Don't you know that yet?
Okay, don't make fun of me. People are listening.
I'm not. I made fun of our country for having changed your language.
Here's the question. How can one be sure that their young adult with autism is ready to drive when nothing is 100% consistent with them? That's a great question.
It is a great question. Although I must admit my immediate answer is I don't know how you can be sure that any young adult with or without autism is ready to drive. You know, this is a completely new set of pressures that have very real consequences, very visible consequences, and it's a very, very scary idea, you know, of make a mistake and get in a car crash, whereas, you know, it's make a mistake in the classroom and no big deal. I think that you probably just have to, if there's some trepidation on Terry's part regarding her child, then Terry probably is on to something that it might be a little bit more challenging for her child. And she's probably right. So what I would suggest is to go slow. You know, don't take the usual student driver classes before you go in for your, you know, at whatever driving school you might have locally. Before you go in and take a driver's test, you know, maybe double up on the lessons and let your teacher at the driving school know that, you know, your kid's just, you know, through no fault of their own, is just going to need a little bit more time and to maybe space the lessons out and be as reassuring and as comforting. You know, getting a good instructor is going to help enormously here, too. You know, if you had the guy that I had, it was just like, do this, do that. Yeah, you screwed up. You know, that's probably not going to work. But I would say maybe investing in, you know, twice as much driving school as other kids as a starter. And also you can help, you know, your child yourself probably by, you know, finding that empty parking lot and just taking them out there with your car and seeing, you know, how much anxiety there is when they're in first gear and going 5 miles an hour and try and work their way up.
I think also a lot of social stories are explaining of how important it is and how serious it is with the driving, in fact, to be consistent. So more discussion about what the importance of, you know, if you make a mistake, as you were explaining, in a car, it's more important or has more detrimental effects than making a mistake in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's an interesting question. Mike from Levittown. My son is 17. He has strong sexual urges and desires. How do you handle that? I don't want to tell him it's wrong, but I have to tell him something. He has had some erotic dreams and release. He says, I can pee on so-and-so. I always tell him in a laughing voice, no, you can't pee on people. Then he asks if he can lay on so-and-so. I always say, no, but you can lie next to someone if she's your girlfriend when you get older. Is that wrong? How do you deal with this?
Well, I think it's really healthy that the 17-year-old has strong sexual urges and desires, just to start. So, obviously, there's a conversation going on about sex between Mike and his son, and that's great. There's not a lot of conversation sometimes between kids on the spectrum and either one of their parents, because I think in past years we got into a really bad habit about not giving kids on the spectrum the same attention for, you know, sexuality curriculums and, you know, sex ed, as we used to call it, based on the idea that we didn't think that, you know, a lot of the more severe cases were ever going to have an intimate life. And that had really bad consequences because, again, the bodies are the same and they change. And if the individual doesn't know why their body is changing, they're going to freak out a little bit, and then you're going to see some behavioral issues, especially in nonverbal individuals that, you know, can't communicate the fact that they're really freaking out over this. I like some of the explanations that Mike has for his son, and I think that the more specific, you're obviously in the midst of a conversation with him, Mike, and, you know, even if you just really start to even get more specific and go over all of the possibilities so that you don't rely on rules so much, because every rule really, you know, you're almost appealing to something about them that can get rules. And, you know, that's the temptation of it, is that, oh, good, you know, he got that rule, so I don't have to teach him as much. But sometimes we rely on the rules too much, and they can be misinterpreted. And a lot of actually, I have a funny story about this that Peter Gerhardt has told in some of his sexuality lessons. He was in a court case in New Jersey where this teenager with Asperger's, fairly challenged Asperger's, though, and he kept going into this local mall, and he kept going up to women and saying, may I touch your vagina? May I touch your buttocks? May I touch your breasts? And the security guards would just, you know, the people would complain. These security guards would boot him out, but he kept coming back. And lo and behold, you know, eventually he's arrested. And Peter gets called into this case. And they do a little digging. And what do they find? They find that this young man was only doing what he was being told to do in his sexuality curriculum, which was, if you want to touch someone, you have to ask. So the lessons may need some modification, and I think that the more specific that you get with your son, now obviously when it comes to things like when is right, you know, especially when we're actually talking about the sexual act, you know, when will I be ready for that, that's when you really need to go into the parameters of getting deeper with the kid, hopefully. And if they need to take example from you as their parent, they might need to based on their level of abilities. But it's something that is an individual decision, and I think that you just need to come up with examples, really basing each example on a specific type of relationship, like one where he's really, really in love with somebody, one where, you know, it's a steady girlfriend and a nice sort of, you know, comforting thing to have for anywhere between 1 month and 3 years while they're in school, or just a casual girlfriend. You just might want to go down all of those specifics. I mean, obviously, this sounds like somebody that has some challenges based on the questions they're asking, and you just need to make sure that, you know, your son is absolutely aware of what's going to get him in trouble. But I kind of like the direction, you know, that you're on with your son, and so I would therefore just say stay on that same path and just do more with it and get more specific.
Here's a question from Dee Dee in Bedford, Virginia. I've heard that males are required to register with Selective Service within a month of turning 18, regardless of disabilities. Is that correct? Does my son with high-functioning autism have to register, even though he cannot read at his age level and doesn't have the same social skills as his peers?
I don't know.
Okay, I know the answer to this.
Please, jump in.
I don't know if they actually have to sign up within a month of turning 18. I do know that your son will receive a letter at his home because my son, who is very impacted by autism, received a letter. So I thought, well, not a big deal, and I started reading down the letter thinking there must be a box somewhere here saying, yeah, because it says reasons why you cannot serve your country. And so I looked for a box that said, you know, has a disability, and there was no such box. And any male that is, alive in the United States and is not in a mental hospital or incarcerated is eligible for military service. So I thought it was pretty funny because I was thinking maybe they could take my son and toilet train him for me. Because that's always an ongoing issue in my house. Even though he was over 18 at the time, that was a joke, Michael. It's okay to laugh. But actually, what we ended up doing on the letter is I made my own box, and I explained a little bit about Jeremy's situation, and I sent the form in, and I've not heard from them since. So I hope that's helpful. I don't know what happens when you have someone who's has high-functioning autism, but that's a very good question. But I do know that they are very serious about their forms, and so I would, if you receive a letter, I would fill it out, and I would do the same kind of thing, make my own box and explain the situation. And if you have a medical professional who, if you have a letter that's explaining of the diagnosis or how it impacts his functioning, you might want to have that ready in case anybody asks you more questions. What do you think about that, Mike?
Dee Dee also, though, mentions that her son has high-functioning autism, and that's the way she put it. And she says that he can't read at his age level,
right. But
she doesn't say he's light years behind his age level. And he says that he doesn't have the same social skills as his peers, but that doesn't say that he's light years behind. In that context, he may very well still be eligible.
I have no idea how they ascertain that, and that's why.
Well, Chantal, we can't ascertain it either. You know, that's part of the thing that we're learning about the diagnosis. And I'll be honest with you, I don't want my son, going into the service. You know, that would scare the heck out of me. But at the same time, on a civil rights level, now this is not, what a concerned mom should be, concerned with, but just as to throw it in there. As life becomes better for all of your children, and as the world starts to become less and less threatened by their behavioral differences, and therefore after that anxiety, anger, and depression that I talked to you about starts to lessen, and we start to see very, very different people still with these same diagnoses, but just behaving very differently because of that loss of that anger, anxiety, and depression, they're going to be capable of anything, whether it appeals to our, personal sensibilities of what we want for our children's work life. I'll be honest with you. I was asked to get involved in a case years ago just shortly after we'd invaded Iraq, and it was a pretty challenged autistic kid who really just plays war video games 24/7, and a less than honorable recruiter had sort of had private conversations with this kid and then signed him up. And this kid was clearly not ready or not able for something like that. And for many people who had opposed the war as well as opposed that, this kid just had been absolutely shanghaied by this really immoral recruiter, they wanted to get us involved in the context of, you can't let them sign autistic kids up like this. You've got to get involved in this. And I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole just because because of the whole possibility that if a kid wants to go into the military and can do it, and I know a lot of people on the autism spectrum that can do it and that do it. You know, the military is, you know, we think of places like the arts and university life as being the best place for a kid on the spectrum to go to because they're the most behaviorally permissive. You know, that person yelled at you, but he's a genius. You know, he can yell at you or something like idiotic like that. But the military can be just as attractive a life based on the fact that they tell you what to do from the moment you wake up until the moment lights go out at night. And that, you know, not having to interpret anything, that's a life that's heaven for a lot of people on the spectrum. So that's probably long outside, you know, your question, Dee Dee, and I hope you'll have forgiven my having gone outside that. But, you know, I'm just glad that Chantal was there to answer it. But it actually does touch on some really, really bigger issues which we're dealing with, and I thank you for being patient with me.
Now, I think it really is, like many things on the autism spectrum, it's a very individual. What's appropriate for one person will not be for another.
Absolutely. And that's what confuses everybody, but unfortunately it's just the truth. This is a very complex gradient, and every attempt to draw a line in the sand where Asperger's becomes autism and vice versa has been proven wrong in practice. And everybody improves, you know, so long as they get the right services. It's just one really complicated, I won't even say gradient because that's one-dimensional. You know, there's three dimensions. There's shadings along the way. And, you know, I guess it just goes back to that great phrase that if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism.
Right. So now I'm going to refer to some of the questions that have come in about vocational in college. Some of them are a little specific, so I don't know if you're able to answer, but you might be able to tell people where to get resources. Here's a couple from Jennifer Eidson from Pennsylvania. Especially in the state of Pennsylvania, are there any kind of training or vocational programs that may be helpful to help them live as independently as possible?
I don't know exactly which ones they are, but I do know that in Pennsylvania there actually is a lot going on. And what I would have Jennifer do is to contact our regional facilitator in Philadelphia, which is Bob Hedin, and maybe ask him for some resources. There's a lot of great groups. Actually, the really best group for her to contact would be Ascend in Philadelphia, which is a parents' organization there.
And how is that spelled, and how could she find them?
I think it's spelled the way the word is. I know there's another Ascend in California, which I think plays with the spelling of it. But I do think it's A-S-C-E-N-D. It's like the Ascend Network of Greater Philadelphia. If you get a woman named Deirdre Wright there, W-R-I-G-H-T, she's absolutely wonderful.
Great. And here's another question from Jennifer. What are the colleges that I've heard about for special needs teens, young adults post-high school? Also, where are they, and would they be something to consider for an autistic individual?
I think the what was the first part of the question again? It just didn't grammatically make sense.
What are the colleges that are available for special needs teens and young adults?
Oh, okay, I didn't hear that word available. Okay. Well, depending on that particular kid's abilities, there's a lot of options. There are colleges that do what's called residential assistance programs, and those are not cheap. You know, there's no federal funding for them, unfortunately. But if you look at something like what Michael Manman has set up with the college internship program. He used to be a board member of ours. And he's got campuses in Brevard, Florida, in Berkeley, Massachusetts, somewhere in Bloomington, Indiana. And he's got two new campuses, one in California, one elsewhere. And a lot of copycat programs have sprung up where you have these living facilities outside the college, and also outside the college tuition, I might add, where there's staff there that teach the kids independent living skills while they're going to college. and, you know, having roommates and dealing with all that sort of stuff, learning how to cook, learning how to clean, as well as providing academic assistance and tutoring if there's need be. But you also have to remember that every college has to have an Office of Student Disabilities, unless they're a religious school. Now, you always should do your homework, that having been said, on whether or not, you know, it's federal law that the colleges have to have that Office of Student Disabilities. And you want to do your homework on which ones are really active in helping their kids with disabilities to navigate life on campus, and which ones just put, you know, the janitor in there on Tuesdays to pay lip service to federal law that they're really resentful they have to, you know, to do anything about. You need to do your homework on that. The other thing to take a look at is the legal protections that you have. And in this particular case, it's Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, and it's also the Americans with Disabilities Act. And what you will need to do, this is very similar to what happens in the workforce, is that if there are problems or if there are challenges in the class, you know, this doesn't have anything to do with the social life, but if there are problems in the classroom, that you can request, usually with the help of a therapist, and this is something that you submit in writing, you can request certain accommodations within that classroom structure. This is not the same, however, as IDEA, which you're all, I'm sure, familiar with, and which basically says that your child is entitled to a wonderful education and one in which they will help you to figure out what your child needs in order to succeed in the classroom. The difference between IDEA, though, and Section 504 and the ADA is that it still gives the school the right to kick your kid out, and you have to be the one to come up with the strategies for what's going to help your child succeed. They don't have to help you along with that. So you've got to be the one, usually with a therapist, to come up with, you know, again, those ideas. And there's a great list, actually, in my book of some of the ideas that you can, you know, request. Once you get in there, and then suddenly you're, you know, realizing, hey, you know, my kid is having, you know, problems in this particular classroom. You could ask for a person to act as a note taker. I'm just sort of going by memory here. You could ask for permission to use a tape recorder, additional time when they're taking tests, written instructions to back up any material presented orally or by the professor in class. You can ask for review sessions, and socially, even through the Office of Student Disabilities, you could ask for peer-run support groups, sort of like what we do at GRASP, where, you know, that office will help to organize all the kids who also have autism and Asperger syndrome and, you know, just provide something like a games night where they can get together once a week or once a month.
I did want to say, though, Michael, that we have to be careful when we're advising parents, because there's one thing that's a big difference between your student before the age of 18 and your student after the age of 18 or when they're at college. Because when they're at college, it is up to the student to advocate for themselves and to be able to ask for those strategies. So you might be able to advise your child, but the college will be talking to your student, and they won't be talking to you if you're at a regular college campus, even with a disability office.
That's absolutely true, Chantal, and I appreciate you having thrown that in there, and it's one that I just made a boo-boo on. For whatever reason, I was sort of assuming that this is pre-college, and that if you know what these challenges might be in advance, that mom or a therapist probably would be helping. But you're absolutely right. When you're in the environment, and this is my bad, your kid has to be the one who advocates for themselves. And, you know, I mean, maybe a phone call to mommy or a phone call to the therapist or consulting with the Office of Student Disabilities, if it's a good Office of Student Disabilities, will help your child come up with what specific ideas to request. But you're absolutely right. They have to be the ones to make those requests.
Right, and which is why it's so important to teach those advocacy skills while they're still in high school.
That's right, and you can't teach advocacy skills unless your kid knows exactly what they've got.
Exactly. Now, I realize we have a lot more questions because people have been sending some in, so I'm going to try and move a little faster here.
All right, I'll try and be a little bit. That's your signal that I need to be a little short-winded, too.
I think we both do. Okay, let me try and find one right now which has to do with work and college, and then we'll go back to some others.
Okay.
This is from Nancy in Watertown. How can I motivate my 23-year-old son to find a job? He has Asperger's syndrome.
Well, right off the bat, that's hard for me to answer not knowing your son. I mean, there's the question of, does he want a job? Does he want a job and just doesn't really, you know, have that work ethic yet that's going to be required for him to go get one? Does he have the social skills to be able to get through the job interview process? And if he doesn't want a job, and if he, you know, wants to stay at home forever and ever and ever, you know, this may have to do with a little bit of depression. And just may require thinking about, you know, ways in which to trick him into wanting, you know, whatever his version of the American dream is going to be someday, rather than anything else. So I guess the only question I have is really look at why it's not happening.
That's a good point, Michael. Here's a question from Stacy in Winter Haven, Florida. I have a son with Asperger's who is almost 9. She picked here 8 3/4. I would say it's almost 9. He has found his private parts. I am thinking that this is kind of early. What do you suggest, and why? What do the teenage years hold in store for us?
Stacy, it is kind of early, but it's not drastically or ridiculously early by any means. You know, kids have erections at that age. You know, and just touching them, you know, is quite easily reads as something that feels good. So why, you know, it's part of the sexuality problem that we have with really, really severely impaired folks is, you know, convincing them that just because something feels really incredibly great, you know, you can't do it any place you want. So I don't know if this holds anything, you know, aside from just really, you know, getting him to understand where and when, you know, it's appropriate to touch himself and where it's not, more importantly. I don't really know if those teenage years hold anything that drastically out of the norm for you.
I think something that's really been helpful for a lot of people, again, on different parts of the spectrum, is to teach the child the concept of private and public. And if you need a visual aid with that, you have like a icon with a stick figure who has all his clothes on that says public, and one an icon with just an underwear that says private. And you teach them, you know, what's appropriate privately and what's appropriate in public. And so when it gets to touching body parts, and then eventually masturbation, and then also when you try and teach them the difference between private conversations and public conversations. For example, something that's appropriate to talk about with the family at the breakfast table, which may not be the same conversation that's appropriate to have in the lunchroom cafeteria. Once they've understood public and private, it makes it so much easier. Wouldn't you agree, Michael?
Agreed, 100%.
I'm trying to think of, like, practical things that might help somebody. But you're absolutely right, Michael. But I had to bring up the private and public because, as Michael has pointed out in an earlier question, it's so important that they learn what is appropriate in public and what is not, because they can get in so much trouble.
Yeah.
Legally and so forth. Okay. Denise in Los Angeles. My 21-year-old son has autism with some Asperger's syndrome characteristics. He has trouble talking about and facing his diagnosis, although he is aware that he has autism. Is there a way to help him understand and face this aspect of his life?
Well, the first trick is, I mean, obviously he's been told what he has, but maybe look back and this is not to, forgive me, this is not to say blame the parent, you know, but just really check to see if you have any work, you know, any backup work to do. But when an individual gets told, there's a big difference between what's going to happen to that kid if they get told as if this is good news or if this is bad news. And it is good
right.
news because, you know, now they're going to have answers for why they might seem different from everybody else. And that's going to help them enormously. You know, you take the kid that has a sensory integration reaction to the school bell going off in the hallway, and or you take two kids that have that same sensory integration reaction, both on the spectrum, but one knows that what they've got and the other one doesn't. The one that knows what they've got walks down the hall and the bell goes off and they have that reaction and it stinks. The second one, who doesn't know what they've got, walks down the hall, the bell sounds, they have that reaction and it stinks. But there's a second layer of, why am I going through this and nobody else is? I feel lousy. And if maybe the child has had, you know, and I'm not assuming that he has, so forgive me if this is really, really not true, but I just have to cover all bases here, that if the child has had a lot of negative iconography having to do with the diagnosis in his life, whether it's words or images, you know, I mean, there's plenty of publicity campaigns out there, you know, that, you know, tell you what an awful thing this is to have. And, you know, well, our population can read and, you know, those words hurt a lot of the time. He also might just have a really strong work ethic, though, where he's one of these kids that just wants to not have any excuses and you know, barrel on and do just the same things that everybody else does. And in those cases, though, it's usually best to just say, but these are not excuses. These are explanations. And to sort of try and get them to see more positive examples of people that have the diagnosis. There's a great book by a woman named Jennifer Elder called Different Like Me. And it just lists a lot of these really famous people that have been diagnosed in retrospect as having, you know, autism spectrum conditions. There's an entire page full of names that I use in a lot of presentations that's just from three books. You know, people like Albert Einstein, Thomas Edison, Thomas Jefferson, Beethoven, Mozart, you know, Glenn Gould. And granted, you know, diagnosing the dead is a, you know, has to be a pretty arbitrary process, and I would never do it because I'm not a clinician, but I like having those positive examples to show people, because in the past, the only positive examples we had as to what was possible if you had one of these diagnoses was, you know, working in, you know, at the cashier at the flower shop in the hospital. And if you really, really provide a lot of positive role models for them, either directly or indirectly, it can somehow relieve a lot of the negative iconography that comes with these words and that we're still battling.
Okay, and while we're on the topic of positive images, I wanted you to mention briefly about that list that's in your book, which I think is a really wonderful and a perfect example of how something can be sounding either negative or can be sounding either positive, and that's how you describe characteristics of someone on the spectrum. Did you want to mention a couple of those, Michael?
Well, if you look at, you know, when we see a characteristic of the diagnosis in those bullet points that we see in books like the DSM-4 or in any, you know, of the, you know, the internet, you know, sites that list, you know, what are the characteristics of this diagnosis, there's an interpretation that explains what the characteristic is. And we sometimes get a very, you know, they're very cold and kind of stigmatizing, you know, descriptions. And so sometimes we get a very negative viewpoint of this particular characteristic. If you look at, let's say, the characteristic that the kid has a really intense absorption in a field or topic of interest, then you get something like, you know, the individual is obsessed and is driven further into this absorption by anxiety and stress. Now, I'm somebody who actually hates the word obsession, because usually what we're talking about is something that in their eyes is a passion. And a passion is a much more positive word than an obsession. And usually kids on the autism spectrum have an ability to bury themselves in work to the exclusion of everything else, work that they love, to a degree that sometimes is their best chance at getting that career. And you don't want to kill that ability to have that kind of passion. But the more positive, you know, interpretation of, again, this intense absorption in a topic or field of interest could just be the individual is passionate. And that sounds a lot different than that critical, you know, interpretation. You could, you know, go with the professorial monotone manner of speaking. And what's right next to the bullet point would be something like stilted awkwardness that is off-putting to others, often preventing further steps in a potential relationship. But you could also spin it as focused on being clear in what is being said by utilizing a strength, text. A discomfort or inability at small talk, the individual sees no logic in it. That could be read as off-putting and impolite, or it could be read as, hey, this guy gets to the point, and for a lot of people, this is going to be really refreshing. So,
yeah,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, those are very good examples. So I'm hoping that helps people who are listening. Should I ask another question?
Absolutely.
Okay, this is from Deidre from Severna Park. She's asking a question. We seem to have more trouble with meltdowns than before. My son just turned 15, but it seems any discipline or correction causes the meltdowns. This makes guidance very difficult. Any suggestion on how to discipline at this age without causing major disturbances?
Well, a lot of times with meltdowns, you're dealing with, you know, somebody that may not be overwhelmed, but certainly feels it. And you have to be careful with discipline, and because discipline is actually quite good, but it's how it's implemented that is going to be very, very key. When we're very, very young, we sometimes get it that things are not working out for us with our peers as they are with other kids. So what do? We grab on to mom and dad a little tighter. And their words of praise and criticism start to mean maybe a lot more than in a normal relationship they should. But that's not going to change. So you got to adapt with it. My son thrives on having rules that have consequences, and lots of them. I did not grow up in an environment that had a lot of rules. So I was a little surprised to see him become this kid that really thrived in, you know, an environment in which there were rules and consequences that were immediately implemented if the rule was broken. No negotiation, or little negotiation. But the trick is, I don't impose any kind of "you've disappointed me" message into it. I don't incorporate any after effects. The consequences implemented, and I'm back to loving him and caring about him, or not loving him, caring about him, but, you know, but being friendly with him just as I was, you know, before this particular incident happened. And I think the trick is that, you know, any kind of instruction consequence has to be doled out as instruction and not as criticism, because that criticism just might be sending your kid over the edge. It's that Mr. Spock portion of things that appeals to their mindset, which actually might even have an advantage because the kid is on the spectrum, because, you know, they just don't experience emotions maybe like most folks, and you know, I certainly didn't. And if somebody just, you know, when I was a kid, would just say, you have to do this and this because this, this, and this. I mean, I'll even go as far to say that I've come to the point in my life where I actually don't even believe in punishment as an idea that works. I do believe in consequences, and I believe in implementing those consequences very quickly and without negotiation. But I don't subscribe to putting any kind of personal reaction alongside the consequence. I think that's where the problem is a lot. Like if he sees mom or dad get upset, a lot of times in the past we thought that that was a good thing because mom and dad were exposing more of themselves to him, communicating to him where they were at. I actually don't think that's a good idea. I think it's better if he sees that mom and dad are still there, that what he has done has not destroyed their world, and that it just is something that he's got to learn on a cognitive level.
Okay, now, Angela from Kansas. With these type of kids, what has been some specific careers that fit their familiar routine types of personalities?
Well, I'll preface this answer by saying that I don't think any kid, you know, I don't think any restriction should be imposed on what careers are possible out there for people. I think that the diagnosis presents challenges which will require them to work harder than others to obtain certain careers, and I think that, you know, it may even present attributes which make certain careers a little bit easier than others. But there's been a lot of stereotypical, you know, sort of pushing kids into fields like IT work, you know, if they're good with computers, or, you know, clerical work, if they're good organizers. A lot of kids on the spectrum are, but a lot of them are really, really good at organizing. And professions like, you know, if you can get your master's in library science, you know, you've got a really decent paycheck to, you know, to be able to build a home out of. These are sort of the stereotyped ones, and sometimes it can vary from kid to kid. You know, math abilities are very often prevalent in kids on the spectrum, and, you know, with that comes music a lot of times, because what is music when you just, you know, bear down to it, but counting. Careers which have stereotypically not been of the best idea are things, you know, anything having to do with interpreting nonverbal social cues, you know, like gestures and tones of voice, and so, you know, customer support areas, you know, sales jobs, you know, these have been professions that have had that red flag of stay away from. But I think that these can be obtainable, even if it's good to know at the offset what the kid is going to be predestined to be a little bit more challenged at and what the kid is predestined to be a little bit good at, and that really varies on the kid.
Okay, here's another question. Name Angela. Do you know of any teenage conferences or Facebook-type sites where these kids can meet, communicate with each other between the ages of 16 and 21?
I don't. Actually, we have a teen Yahoo group, which you can subscribe to off our website. But I'll be honest with you, it's had very little activity. And I would love to see it get off the ground so she can maybe help us out and, you know, get those conversations started, because we have kids that are subscribed to it. We just don't see any activity on it whatsoever. There's one that Delphi Forums used to have, but Delphi Forums, it's DelphiForums.net. But Delphi Forums throws a lot of advertising on you, and, you know, in order to stay in their free zone, you have to put up with a lot of the pushy advertising for them to, you know, trying to sell you on how much better the per pay, you know, group is. And that can be really annoying after a while. So I would suggest trying to get the Grasp Teen Yahoo group going a little bit more.
Okay, that sounds interesting. We do need more of those kinds of things up there.
Yes, we do.
Okay, here's another one. Here's an interesting one, Michael, and it's personal, so maybe perhaps you will not want to respond, but it's from Barb in Nashville.
Where oh, please, Barb, shoot at anything. I mean, I'm to a fault, open to anything.
Okay. How did your diagnosis of AS affect your marriage?
Well, I think that it was really good in the context that for all the times that my wife had thought that I was rude to her, she found out I wasn't, or that I didn't intend to. You know, it's the old, how do I look you know, do I look fat in this dress? Yes, you know, conundrum. And that, I think, made things a lot easier on her. I think that there was, I'll be honest with you, I'm on my second marriage now. And I was, at the time when I was diagnosed, I was still in my first marriage. I don't think, because she was the one, though, that had actually been the first to sort of trick me into reading an article on Asperger's syndrome regarding our son when she had it in her mind that it was something that really, you know, included the both of us. And she was actually very, very supportive of getting the diagnosis, finding out a lot about this other stuff. She and I were just, it was a very amicable breakup. And we were just, you know, good friends who admired each other's work and who, when we both got married for reasons of our own, we just didn't really understand what real love was. And, you know, once we came to realize that, it was kind of a really, you know, mutual, not so tragic and not so disastrous experience for us. But I will tell you that I have seen a lot of other times that the partner that doesn't have AS in the marriage very often can sometimes try and blame all the problems of the marriage on the AS. And in my experience, there's never a good guy and a bad guy in a marriage. And my first wife had some issues of her own. People come together for very good reasons. Whether those reasons have a name attached to it or not, they usually at least find, and they know enough about each other, or they should, that it's a good fit. It whether it's going to be a good fit forever is going to depend a lot on a lot of hard work and a lot of hard compromise. And, you know, also whether or not it's the real thing. I'm trying to just sort of think and remember back to that particular time. I mean, I think most of all it was, you know, even though the marriage ended, I know this is going to sound like a weak argument, but I really actually think it helped because it really clarified not only for me, you know, so much of my life and made me feel better about who I was, but if your partner feels better about who they are, your life is going to be easier.
Right. That's true. Even for people not on the spectrum.
Absolutely.
Okay, so quite a few more questions here. Here's one from Janice Lawrence in Kent. I have an 11-year-old who has spent most of his school years in a self-contained classroom with very little integration despite numerous requests for inclusion with his typical peers. His behaviors always get in the way. Can you advise how I can convince them to provide more inclusion opportunities for him? He is academically bright, but he is verbally and socially delayed. I am fearful of the junior high years, which are to start next year, and afraid that he will be stuck in a self-contained classroom until he graduates. Social groups are few and far between here, and we don't have family nearby to practice with. I really want him to be retained for another year to work on his social skills, but don't think that's going to happen. He is having his three-year evaluation soon, and the retention issue has yet to be decided. Any advice would be appreciated.
Well, number one, you have to, you know, again, look at that question of desire, and does this kid want to interact with those other kids? In other words, is he willing to put in an effort to, you know, change certain social patterns of his? But the other thing is that it sounds to me like you have that right by changing the IEP,
okay.
Especially if you have the three-year evaluation coming up. So it should be something that's fairly easy to, not fairly easy, nothing in, you know, the school boards is fairly easy, but compared to some of the other nightmare scenarios, this one sounds like it would be, you know, a lot easier to be able to implement just by changing the IEP. In terms of changing his, you know, if he's really, really happy in his self-contained class right now, if he's really, you know, if he's sort of at the top of the class socially and just needs to kind of branch out, I can understand that. But if he's sort of more in the middle and he's just really happy where he is, I'm not so sure I would push him to do more, or at least have an escape hatch so that he can go back to it if it doesn't work out.
Well, I think also that she, or this parent, seems to be asking for at least more inclusion opportunities, even if she's not always the not total integration. But it is true what Michael was saying, that you have the right. But it's really up to the school district to prove that there's a reason why your child should not be in general education. And you can always have your child mainstreamed for a few classes a day if that's what would be good for him.
Or even just one class a day.
Yes, just by the fact they may try and say, well, he academically can't fit into this class or he's not at that level. It doesn't matter. You can base it on social skills needs, because everyone needs to know how to sit with other people and how to be around other people. And so that's really just a very basic thing. But Michael's right in that you do have to be careful on in seeing what is your son's comfort level. But
yeah,
it's true that even if his comfort level is that he doesn't want to be at all outside that classroom, I think he needs to start little by little having that opportunity, because his whole life is not going to be self-contained.
And let's just take a nightmare situation where, you know, let's say you don't, you know, the school board wants to put up a fight. You don't have the money to pay for, you know, a special ed lawyer. And the school board's, you know, just going to, you know, win with ugly, ugly muscle. You can get him involved in some after school things to see how that works, whether that's, you know, sports or whether it's scouting. You know, you can use those as sort of your, you know, experiment.
That's an idea, too. Okay, here's one with, here. Barbie in Houston. I have a 22-year-old son with autism. He does not want to wear clothes. Currently receiving ABA. I'm unable to take him out because he will not keep his clothes on. I have tried sensory integration therapy, but he would not go into the therapist's room. Any suggestions? That's difficult.
It is difficult. You know, I'm glad he's getting the ABA. You know, it may just be a situation where, I mean, I think that the sensory specialist is going to be kind of key here, because, you know, the clothing might, you know, very well be a sensory issue as opposed to a, you know, just a willful rebellion sort of issue.
Maybe the therapist could go in the home, or at least give some advice to mom as to what to try. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, well, you could also, you know, just trick him. You know, by, you know, maybe if this child is aware that, you know, there's so many unknowns in this particular case, you know, whether or not the kid has a general distrust of clinicians, whether the kid is sick and tired of going to the doctor's office, all these issues seem to come into play in terms of finding a really, really good solution. I mean, if this kid,
a young man, he's 22.
Hmm?
He's 22, so it's a young man.
Yeah. I mean, I say a kid developmentally, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
I wish I knew more. I wish I knew more about what type of a reaction he has, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to question. Maybe if she's listening now, she'll write some more information.
Yeah, write some more information if you can, ma'am, and get it to us. It might help us.
Okay.
But when I say trick him, you know, if that sensory therapist can get to the, can come to your home, you know, maybe, you know, just announce the person as a babysitter for a little bit. See what happens.
That's a good thought. Okay, here's a question from April Lumaro. Why is it okay for some teachers to limit the talents of children with autism? I believe my daughter can do anything, and I would never say she's only good at wrapping silverware. What are your thoughts? I guess they're having her busy wrapping silverware with paper towels or napkins.
Right. Well, some teachers are just incredibly stupid. And, you know, it's a profession that probably should be the highest paid of any profession on the planet and is unfortunately one of the lowest paid. But one of the nice things about making one of the highest paid is we could get rid of, you know, some of the dumber ones. Information, again, really, really trickles down. And it may just be that, you know, we all have good and bad teachers. Hopefully the next one, you know, won't be as bad. I think you just really need to maybe go over this particular teacher's head and talk about what a negative influence this teacher's, you know, limiting opinions of what her daughter can do are doing to her. And talk about how, you know, a much more positive approach that preaches the possible as opposed to the probable, you know, even if the probable in this case is you know, right or wrong, you want to have somebody that, you know, that believes that your child can advance. And so I would just suggest that, you know, you go over this teacher's head and lobby very, very strongly for this. And even if they can't, you know, fire the teacher or get you a new teacher or something like that, hopefully some system of accountability will be placed on this teacher where they now know that, you know, it's not just the mom that knows how negative that they're being with the child.
Right. Good suggestion. Here's one a question I really like, Michael, and I'm hoping you can help this woman. Susan from Birmingham, how could you deal with this stubbornness issue, especially when the child insists that he is right and you, the mom, are wrong?
Knowing about the diagnosis, understanding the dogmatic, black and white way we sometimes think, and then cognitively getting him to understand that this is a process that is not going to happen overnight. But getting the child to understand, sorry, that was my voicemail, getting the child to understand that the strength of his argument and the soundness logically of his thinking is not the most important factor in this person-to-person relationship. So that it's not, you know, if you can use that kid's cognitive, you know, pragmatic mindset and twist it around on him and include a pragmatic message that they are often wrong, and we are. You know, we get ideas in our heads that are just so sound logically that we can't believe that the rest of the world doesn't operate like this. You know, Chantal very nicely, you know, rattled off some of my career achievements. Well, let's talk about when I first got out of graduate school. And I had a master's degree in playwriting, which for economic reasons, you might as well put that degree under the bottom of a birdcage. So I had to go out and, you know, find other jobs and go through the whole, you know, temp thing, trying to find stuff. And every time I would go into a new job, I would immediately impress people because of my work ethic and because of what I could do right off the bat. And I would start to get impressions about how that entire business worked. And they were just so solid in my mind. They were just so absolutely, you know, it just worked. And not only was I wrong about how that business worked, always, but I had to understand the cognitive notion that my opinion on how that place should be run was not as important as the boss's opinion. And the boss's opinion mattered more because if I wasn't doing what the boss wanted me to do as opposed to what I thought I should be doing, I was going to lose my job. And that's just the way the world works. Now, you can't just say that's just the way the world works till you're blue in the face with a kid with a yes, I know. And that's why I say you really have to start to get them to cognitively understand the diagnosis, because once you do that, it won't be so negative when you hit them over the head with, you're wrong an awful lot. You may think you're right, but you're wrong an awful lot. And now if I prove that you're wrong, will you take this to heart the next time, you know, you get really, really, you know, zealous about another idea in your head? It's a long process of whittling that particular hardline edge down to something softer.
Okay, now Barbie from Houston has written a little more information here. She says that's the one with the not wanting to keep his clothes on at all. She can't get him into the sensory integration therapist's office.
Oh, thank you, Barbie.
Yeah. My son is nonverbal. We can keep shorts on him if we keep him busy, but only for short times. He will not wear shirts, underwear, or shoes. He started not wanting to wear underwear and socks, then progressed to not wanting shirts. Now he does not want to wear anything. It does sound like a lot of sensory integration stuff.
No, it doesn't.
Oh? You don't think it does?
But if he could take clothing earlier, it's gotten worse, not better.
I guess because when she said he started by not wanting to wear underwear and socks, those are tighter things. So then he was okay with looser clothes.
But he used to be okay with shirts, and now he's not.
That's true. It sounds like it started, it's sort of like it started with one little thing and then it got worse.
Yeah.
It's really hard. I'm surprised the ABA people aren't able to address it, but I still would want to know more about what the sensory integration person has to say.
I would too. I mean, I'm not saying it's not worth a check. You know, every behavior has an origin. And the problems, the more you get into the really challenged areas of autism, is finding out what the origin is, where that sense of distrust or discomfort or confusion, you know, lies, and be able to communicate something that makes that individual feel a little better. And, you know, this is all about communication. This is all about whether, you know, it's the high end of Asperger's, the low end of autism. I mean, it's one world, you know, it's two worlds, you know, trying to communicate with each other and often failing because we just don't know enough. And I would also if the kid is getting ABA, that should be covered in that, don't you think? I'm trying to think of another, you know, sort of therapeutic approach to this other than the sensory therapist and the ABA practitioners, but I'm just not coming up with anything.
I still think it's necessary to find out more from the sensory integration person.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. I just don't think that in the end, you know, I mean, you got to, because it's a possibility, but I don't think it's a probability if the kid was comfortable with things before. Usually, you know, you do see improvements, even if it's not the speed you want. But you don't see regressions in sensory integration issues usually.
Yeah, but sometimes you get into bad habits. So, for example, if he started having less and less clothes on and he was permitted to do that, then it just kind of goes downhill from there. I'm just saying this as a parent. I know, like, with my son, if we give him a little slack with a behavior and, you know, we get a little loose on the rules and all of a sudden, you know, 6 months later, we're like, oh, my gosh, how did we get to this point? But I think that the ABA people should be able to help with the desensitization program. And I'm sure this mother has tried a lot of different things, but, you know, where he wears his clothes for a certain amount of time or certain things for a certain amount of time and then adding to that.
Yeah, I was gonna add to that idea by saying, you know, just garden variety positive reinforcement where, you know, if there's an activity that the kid loves or a food that the kid loves, you know,
right,
you get more of this if you will wear some clothes.
Right.
you know, and see what happens. Or, you know, if, you know, this is very risky, but, you know, maybe subtracting certain pleasurable things, you know, if the clothing doesn't get warm.
The good thing is that if he is having ABA, then you have a professional there to help you with those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe you might want to switch ABA therapists.
True.
Again, you might be dealing with somebody that's just, you know, I mean, they're again, we're talking about, you know, the singer, not the song. You maybe have, you know, have somebody that's teaching the appropriate therapy for your child, but just isn't very good at it.
Yeah, or maybe they're used to a different type of person with autism, you know, or
yeah.
Younger. Or...
Yeah.
Okay, we have only 9 minutes left, actually 8 minutes. So let's move on here. Here's an interesting question. Tony Cochran in Snellville, how can you get an adult diagnosed when they do not realize that they are? Very hard for our grandson who has been diagnosed with PDD to relate to his father. The father has a PhD and continues to blame the mother and disputes the diagnosis. I think there's questions there. Actually, how do you get an adult diagnosed when they do not realize that they are? Well, first of all, that would have to be a professional doing that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Very hard for our grandson that's been diagnosed with PDD to relate to his father. The father has a PhD and continues to blame the mother and disputes the diagnosis. Any suggestions for that part of it, Michael?
Well, I do and I don't. I mean, I have an observation, but it's not a pretty one. The one thing I've always found I can't do anything about is denial. You can plant the seed, and sometimes the best result is simply to, you know, provide consequences. More marriages have ended because of one partner's inability or unwillingness to look at themselves in the mirror for this diagnosis than they have by getting the diagnosis, and that's probably by a 100-to-1 margin. This is an individual that we have to remember probably grew up back when, you know, these words had even darker connotations to them when they were heard than they do today, and more negative stigma. And that if something like this applied to you, that you really were a broken individual and doomed to second-class citizenship and a lot of other bad things. There's an amazing, you know, Twilight Zone episode from 60 years ago when this really racist guy wakes up one morning to find out he's black. And I see this a lot with folks that, you know, grew up maybe as, you know, they were even, you know, bullies at one point or another about kids with special needs and made fun of them. And lo and behold, one day they get the diagnosis themselves. I'm not saying that this person is definitely that type, but if you've grown up with certain ideas about disabilities, then if those were some of the more negative ideas, then this sort of a process becomes even harder for you. The person definitely needs to either be approached in a really gentle way, again, is to say this is good news, not bad news we have for you, or if at the least, you know, the person can either read my book or, say, Tony Atwood's first book if they want a more clinical perspective. Not Tony Atwood's later book, but his first book, which is just called Asperger Syndrome. It's from 1998. Don't get the complete guide to Asperger Syndrome from 2 years ago, which I just don't think is helpful in this situation. Otherwise... you know, this individual might lose, you know, people that he loves. And that would be very, very sad, but maybe, sometimes I hate to say this, but the threat of such a loss is sometimes the only thing that can, you know, make people realize I really need to look at this for myself because I'm just making everybody unhappy by my unwillingness, not by my diagnosis, but my unwillingness to look at this.
Not an easy situation.
No, it's an awful situation.
We only have 4 minutes, and I'm going to ask you a last question, okay?
Okay.
My son is very unmotivated. What are some ways to get him motivated into doing things? And this person did not put their name, so that's why I didn't mention who it is.
Well, I think we were asked this question a little bit about the kid who, you know, wouldn't go out and get a job.
Right, but this one is sort of the same issue because it all has to do with motivation. So,
right.
Just wanted to know, because people do bring up the motivation aspect, do you have any little hints of advice for us about how to get someone on the spectrum motivated? Doesn't matter whether it's for a job or for school, but it is a big issue for many people.
Well, I think really sort of outlining what the long-term plan is going to be for them if they continue to go unmotivated, and what the long-term plan will be for them if they can get motivated. And if you can kind of sell them rather than tell them on why it's in their best interest to go out and do things, that's maybe going to be a huge part of the equation. But if the person is just really depressed and has had a truckload of bad experiences where they're just, you know, they just have no energy, then that's where you need some, you know, garden variety therapy for depression with a therapist that knows their AS a little bit. And again, they also may need those same positive role models in those books. You know, all those famous people, if they're feeling, you know, depressed in particular about maybe having, you know, really negative feelings about the fact that they do have the diagnosis.
You know,
and trying to change that into a positive feeling.
Giving them role models, and there are books out there with role models about people on the spectrum.
Books that list all these famous, you know, individuals diagnosed in retrospect.
That's correct. Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure having you here on the seminar. We didn't answer absolutely all the questions, but practically. And I want to remind everyone that you've been listening to Michael Giancarli, who's the Executive Director of GRASS, and also the author of Asperger's from the Inside Out, a supportive and practical guide for anyone with Asperger's syndrome. And you can find out more about GRASS and about Michael on www.grasp, that's GRASP, .org. Thank you so much for being here this evening, Michael.
Chantal, my pleasure. And if I can just add one thing on the book, and that is that the book is for those individuals being diagnosed late in life, but half the market, as we sort of knew that it would, was for family members and clinicians that, you know, sort of get an inside track as to, you know, what their loved ones might be going through.
Very good point. It is very useful for parents of kids with autism. I found it extremely useful from just to understand, because you explain your life story and growing up as a child, and it can help you understand what it's like for someone, for your child who is facing this every day at school and in the community. Thanks again, Michael.
Chantal, thank you, and thank everybody for calling in or listening.
That's right. Goodbye, everybody.
The moderator has disconnected. The call will now end. Welcome to the conferencing service. Please enter your conference ID followed by the pound sign. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Incorrect conference ID. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Conference ID accepted. The moderator has not yet arrived. Please wait.